like to deal with the difficult Medrash regarding Rosh Hashanah. One of them was raised, actually two Midrashim, one of them was raised by the Kapishnitzer Rebbe the other night when we had the Chanukah Rabbayit for the Boston community. The full Medrash goes like this. Rosh Hashanah is in, Din has arrived, it's time for judgment. The son approaches Hashem and says, I would like to testify against people, against mankind. And Hashem says, well, son, you know the rules. In the Torah, we demand two witnesses, and you're only one. The son says, I have a second. And the moon comes along and joins up together with the sun. And he says to Hashem, I'm ready to testify together with the sun. The two of us together, we're the witnesses. Okay, what's the testimony? And they go ahead and they say, accusing testimony about the Jewish people. And then all of a sudden the shofar sounds. And the moon gets scared. He can't take it. The moon goes away, and what's left is the sun. And Hashem says, I'm sorry, son. You're only one witness. You're not good enough to testify. It's not going to work. So, it all falls apart. No attack against the Jewish people. This is a medrash that requires a lot of explanation. What is going on here? The sun, the moon. The moon gets scared away. The sun does not get scared away. Why does it get scared away? By a few sounds of the shofar. And then there's another medrash. And the second medrash is that when you blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, it's a clear success only for Rosh Hashanah. We have no idea, though, if it's going to really be a success and if it's going to be accepted in heaven. And what's the sign, the proof? If it was good, if it worked? When the Jewish people take their lulav and esrog and they put it next to each other, that's proof that the shofar was good. The question is, what is the lulav and esrog? Why is the medrash putting these two mitzvot together? What do they have to do with each other, and how is it proof? In order to understand this, we have to try to really understand a little bit more deeply what the sun is, what the moon is, in this medrash. Rav Soloveitchik says beautifully, the sun is the concept of clarity. And the sun comes out and says, the Jewish sins, each and every individual sins that he did publicly, it's clear. I don't have to hide it. I don't have to sneak it in. It was blatant. Look at that transgression, God. He doesn't care. And that's the sun. Who's the second witness? The moon. The moon glows when it's night, when it's dark out, and it's not clear. Because we've got a whole bunch of sins that aren't as blatant, they're not as clear. And the moon, the Rav said, comes along, points out even the times when we were doing mitzvot, we were trying to do good, but the agenda was not great. And comes the moon. I want to show you that even to moonlight, even those things that are a little bit hidden, those aren't so great either. And you have the sun showing Hashem the clear, blatant transgressions. And you have the moon showing us, showing Hashem that which is hidden in our neshama, hidden in our hearts, that maybe that's not all that great either. When I was in high school, I used to lean and daven for an old age home. But I can't say that the agenda was all that lishma. It was a 2-mile walk from our home, so maybe, you know, we're real tzaddikim. We schlepped out 2 miles to lane and daven. But the truth be told, I've never laughed so hard in my life. Those old people, it was just too good to pass up. Rabbi Yudin, our shul rabbi, once came in for a bar mitzvah in the community. And the following story took place, and when this happens, in my presence, I realized that's what differentiates the men from the boys. And I was clearly not in the men category when I was in high school. He takes the bar mitzvah boy, he puts his arm around his shoulder, and he says, "You know, you're so lucky now, you know how to lane." You know why? Because when I learned how to lane, I made sure to learn all the parshiot so I could lane for an old age home. And I'm thinking, yeah, like me, right? And then he said, "And you know, in an old age home, they're hard of hearing. Could you imagine how hard I had to study those parshiot knowing that no one would be able to correct me?" That's where I realized the difference. We were like, what the, you know, they can't hear anyway. No one's going to know. And even those mitzvot that we do may not have always been with the greatest agenda. And who knew? The moon. That's the idea of the moon. Comes to let the Ribbono Shel Olam in on this secret and accuse us. And then we blow the shofar. And what's the shofar? Well, a lot of us have trouble with davening. A lot of us have trouble with stamina in davening. And you get to the end of a tefillah when you're interested to actually connect to God and you're wondering, you know, I don't know if that one went so well. What do I do now? I'll daven again? Okay, we've got a whole bunch of them on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And what about after that? And I did it again. You know, I did what I could. I focused as much as I could. But then I lost concentration. Now what? Comes the shofar. And the shofar is the simple sound from the heart, way down, deep inside, screaming out to Hashem, "I really do care. I really do want to be close to you. And I really do, deep down, have a little piece of my neshama that wishes that all the muck and dirt that I let get in the way wouldn't be there." And when that sound screams out from your heart, the moon is silenced. The moon no longer has what to say. The sun, it's true, we do mess up. Blatantly. But I have a deep desire down in my heart that I really do want to be close. For the first time in my life, I was in the University of Maryland in a way this summer that I had never visited the university before. I had visited a number of times before this summer, but each time I went, it was either in one of our alumni's apartments that he had rented off campus, it was in the Hillel, it was in various places, but it was never in the commons, the main dormitory. And quite a nice dorm at that. And this summer, I got to see a slightly different picture. And it was beautiful. And the picture that I saw, and I've been to secular universities, quite a number of them, not for my own college career, usually visiting. And I never saw this picture, even though it exists basically on every university campus in America. Well, there was a boys' floor and a girls' floor, and a boys' floor and a girls' floor. That's good. And then, each floor, each dorm, it's like in Leva Torah, they had a great idea. Make it into apartments. Nobody likes the old corridor system, a long hallway, rooms right across from each other. We're going to have apartments. And each guy that zocheh to get his fate land in the commons, so he gets his own room in each apartment. So in each apartment, you have about 3-4 rooms, and in each room, you have one student, one college student. And on each floor, at the end of the hallway, you have the RA's room, the resident advisor. And next to that is a large open area that is meant and designated for parties. It's designated, Isurim start here. And then they continue in the rooms. And here was the chop. You see, my brother-in-law was in a secular university, my sister was in a secular university, but they shared rooms with people. So, like, you can't actually bring Nashim into your domain with privacy and do as you wish, and everybody is happy with that. There was some inhibitions, and you had to, like, go out of your way. Here, it is no longer difficult. It is Beheter Gamor. So I asked, well, what does the RA do? What's his job? When it gets rowdy and violent, he has to break it up. Drugs? That's mutter. Drinking? Totally encouraged. Girls? That's what we're here for. So this summer when I got back, and I was telling my sister this wonderful, wonderful picture. So she told me that there was a story just recently, unfortunately, of some high school girls that came to her home on a Friday night, rather late. They were very disturbed, totally distraught. There was a boy in their grade that his parents went away for the weekend. And, of course, he's allowed to stay home and invite some friends. Parents are away. Why they actually think this is a great idea, that we'll let our children throw parties in the house when we're away. Okay? So, the guys invited guys and girls. Beautiful. They spiked the drinks of the girls. These two girls came a little bit late to the party. And when they walked in, they saw something rather horrific, at least in their eyes. And that is that the girls were no longer clad with all that much. They were running around the house. And the guys were having a great time. They were pretty happy with themselves. And they had no idea what to do. And they ran to my sister's home, who was one of their teachers. What are we supposed to do? And that was the scenario. And here, we are faced with something very, very important. Yosef, as in one of the brothers, is known as Yosef HaTzadik. What did Yosef do that granted him the title Yosef HaTzadik? Why is he the Tzadik? And the Medrash explains, you know how he became known the Tzadik? Because there was a point in time when he decided, maybe I'll throw it all away, because there was this woman, Potiphar's wife, who decided she was going to be after Joseph, and she got him, and he decided, oh no, you don't. He left his clothing, ran outside in the hall, and ended up in jail with no clothes. And for withdrawing from that moment and deciding not to go through with it, he became known as Yosef HaTzadik. Now there are a number of difficult questions with this idea. Difficulty number one, how did she get his clothing? That doesn't just accidentally... Well, it was a strong hold, you see. Really? Like, what exactly... We just justify it in our minds. Well, you know, like clothing back then. Yeah, like, and what about the clothing back then? It fell apart because it was just a bunch of fig leaves? How in the world did that happen? Number two, and probably much more problematic, is he became known as Tzaddik for that. Now, there are a lot of Gedolei Adar. I cannot imagine if the story goes out in the front page of the newspapers, you'll never guess, but this Gadol Adar, he refused adultery. He is truly a tzaddik. I sure hope he would refuse that. And you know what? He would not be granted the title tzaddik just for that. I sure hope that would be understood as a davar pashut. There's no taiva. Wow, this guy, you know, he knows Kola Tarakula. He's removed sleep from his eyes. Sticks his feet in cold water to make sure he could learn extra. Never says a word Lashon Hara. That does not grant him the title tzaddik. But, you know, when a woman offered himself, now he is a tzaddik. We're talking about the tzaddike olam here. We're talking about adultery. She was a married woman. And therefore, I'd like to bring out a different version as to what exactly happened over there. See, Yosef got thrown into a pit. But before that happened, he was sent on a mission. Go check out your brothers, see how they're doing. Now, he and his brothers didn't really get along so well. He gets sold after almost getting killed. He's not really a desirable entity by his brothers. Am I a desirable entity by my father? Does my father care about me anymore? Who knows? He sent me on the mission. I know he really loves me. He gave me a coat and he learned with me extra. I know he does love me. Fine. So he loves me. But then why hasn't he sent for me? Maybe he agrees with my brothers. And maybe he agrees. I'm off. And therefore I should remain in Egypt. What's he thinking for all those years? And then comes the day of fate, where he has to make a decision. And she's interested in him. She says, Joe, let's go. Husband's out of the house. It's a party. And you know what he says? Yes. I'm interested too. And that's the background of the story. Nobody cares. He's the kid that's off the derech. His father is a good from guy. Certainly would wish for the best for his son. But the kid is off the derech. Typical. Totally typical. His mother's dead. He's got a father that doesn't care about him. And he's on his own. He's got brothers that certainly don't care. Maybe his father does. Maybe his father does. He has no idea. And no one's going to ever find me. I've been here now for a few years. And no one's looked for me. Why? Why keep it? For who? So I might as well. And the Medrash comes along and says, he's in bed, and all of a sudden he sees an image of his father, and he pulls away. What's that image of his father? That image, I believe, is right before that moment, that single moment of decision, that would have totally changed his history. He realized, I still have a Masora. I still have a connection from my father. I really want to throw it away? It's a 1 second thing. It doesn't mean anything. I really want to throw it away? This decision right here, right now? Maybe I do have a connection. Maybe I still have that piece of my father in me. I'm out of here. I can't go through with this. And he pulled back at that last moment. And for that, the guy that had every reason to throw it away. He had no reason to believe that Am Yisrael would care about him. Maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu rejected him. And I have a whole slew of reasons why he should think that. Avram and Yishmael. Abraham has two kids, Yishmael and Yitzchak. Who gets rejected? Yishmael. Who gets chosen? Yitzchak. Where does Yishmael end up? In Chutz Laaretz. The rejected one ends up in Chutz Laaretz. Yitzchak has two kids, Yaakov and Esav. What's Yaakov terrified of? That maybe Esav was the right one, I was the wrong one. How could that be? Of course he's the right one. Because where did he end up? In Chutz Laaretz. The loser ends up in Chutz Laaretz. Yaakov has 12 kids. One ends up in Chutz Laaretz. The loser ends up in Chutz Laaretz. He has every reason to throw it away. But last minute, he says no. Last minute, he blows that shofar. No, I'm not going to do this. Deep, deep down, past the moon, I really do care. I really do want. Going back to our stories of the wonderful universities, every single person has choices to make. And here's the issue. Most of the time, even if we put the Isurim aside, most of the time, someone gets hurt in these parties. And it's usually the girls. And the guys, no skin off my back, I could care less. Doesn't hurt me. Only hurts them. They're expecting a full-fledged commitment. I don't care about that. I could hurt them. Just as being a decent person. Just because you'd want to be a decent person. That in itself should be reason to withdraw from such a thing. I'll hurt the next person. What do I care? It's crude. In other words, we all have these fantasies and Hollywood plays right into them, and we play right into them. And how much we love entering and delving into fantasies. But when the fantasies actually introduce themselves as reality, are you ready to put your actual basic sense of decency, ideas of right and wrong aside for the fantasy? Or are you ready to say, no, it was just a fantasy and it's wrong and I'm putting that aside? That's the shofar. The shofar comes along to blow from your innermost sense of right and wrong. I really do want what's right. Everyone's had, at various points, a certain moment of inspiration in their lives. Inspiration towards more Kedusha, towards something holier, something bigger. Everyone's had that. That's why they're here. And you get to choose every instance in your life. Am I going to take that moment? Am I going to grow with it? Am I going to leave it? Let it stay at rest. Rosh Hashanah time, we get to address that with ourselves, our neshamas. When the oracle of the matrix turns to you and says, I'm sorry, but you're not the one. You're just not it. You could have been, but you're not it. What are you going to say? No, but you don't understand. I had that thought. Yeah, I am it. I really am, because I had those moments of inspiration. I remember them vividly. Yeah, but you haven't played them up. You haven't taken them seriously. That's the shofar. And now, how do you know if that shofar is a success and you're not just wishful thinking yet again? And the answer becomes the lulav and esrog. The lulav and esrog. What's that? The lulav and esrog, see, is a funny thing. Because we have this strong minhag. It's not brought down basically anywhere. Not in the Gemara. Not even in the Shulchan Aruch. You take your lulav in the right hand. The esrog in your left hand. That's stated all over the place. But then there's this strong minhag that we all know. Maybe it's the last remainder of oral law. You put them together. You're supposed to put them together. Okay? We're going to put them together. Now that's a little technical problem for those people that actually want to say the Hoshanos properly, because you have to hold your sitter somewhere. So you like try to balance it on your hands, and then you stab the guy in front of you, and he turns around and becomes a sword fight with the lulav, and it's like creates all these technical problems. So now it's good for fundraising opportunities. Chabad put out like the lulav estrog sitter holder, so it helps their donors. They could go with ease. Everyone else still has to fend for themselves. And where do we have this minhag? Like, what is it? What's the pshat of this idea? There was a story in my days in high school, way back in the early 20s. And Deal High School ended up actually making it somewhere in basketball. And the Hillel and Deal, they did really well that season. They did so well that they were finally up to par with MTA, my alma mater. And they were the champs. They made it into the finals. They were going for the tournament in Madison Square Garden. They got there. That was probably, you know, for them, pretty overwhelming a sight. The MTA Giants versus the Deal little guys. And, okay, they gave it their all. They were doing pretty well. Now you have to understand one little nakuda about the Syrian community. In the Syrian community, they almost never marry out. Nobody marries out. By them, if you marry out, you are wiped out from the community. You will not get inheritance. You will not be spoken to by anyone in the community. So nobody marries out. In the Ashkenazic world, we have intermarriage, unfortunately, quite a bit. And there's a certain acceptance of, well, if I wipe them out, should we go that far? Maybe we should still accept them. And there's all this inner conflict and turmoil. However, the result of that is that the frum in the Orthodox circles is a little bit frummer. While in the Syrian community, everybody's in. But everyone together is a little bit less. But they're all in together. And it's very interesting, different communities. And those that are Ashkenazic probably have no clue about anything regarding the Syrian community. Like, they don't eat the same foods. It's a different world. They eat edje, lachmaji, jachnun, all these other things. And we eat, like, other things. When I was teaching some Syrians, so one of them, one Erev Shabbos, decided to bring over his present for Shabbos, which was a Syrian cookbook. He said, Mrs. Benji, next time you cook our food. All right, and that was the gift for Shabbos. The Syrian kids, they didn't really wear a yarmulke. Kippah is not one of the things that ever took off in the community. It wasn't accepted by the entire community the way it was by the Ashkenazim. So they're playing, and one of the stars, Jack Assis, he was on the bench, the beginning of the fourth quarter. And he's sitting there, and the rabbi of the school goes down to the bench and he says, Jack, you know, you're about to drink some water. Maybe say a bracha and put on the kippah. Okay. Sure. Yeah. They need all the help they can get right now. Fine. And he finds a kippah somewhere and he says his bracha. And as fate would have it, it was at the very last few seconds of the game. MTA took a shot, missed, it rebounded, 3 seconds left, Jack got the ball,
started running right after half court, threw it, buzzer sounds, went right in, and Hill Deal took the championship. The entire team runs, grab Jack, they're throwing him up. The rabbi goes right onto him, Jack, you did it! You're the star! And Jack, he was flying up in the air, goes, Rabbi! It was the Biracha! You did it! And he's like, no, forget the Biracha, it was you! And he's like, no, Rabbi, the Biracha! He couldn't imagine, he couldn't believe it. At the moment of his highest glory, this guy, he did it! And he's looking deep down, and he recognizes it was a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That Esrog, there are four opinions what the fruit of Gan Eden was. And one opinion is that it was an Esrog. If Soloveitchik came along and said, you know what pshat of that medrash is? That Esrog that you take on Sukkos, you put it back on the tree. And say, we've messed up. But that's not where I want to be. I want to put that Esrog back together with the lulav where it belongs. It's the Biracha. Deep down, I know it's right. Deep down, I want to hold on. If you're still saying that message, 15 days later comes Sukkos, we know your Rosh Hashanah was a success. And Mirtz Hashem, everyone should, this Rosh Hashanah, find those moments of inspiration. Take them seriously. Take them real seriously. See how much you could build on them, how much you could maximize on them. Everyone wants to be the good guy. And sometimes when being the good guy is tough, we fall a little. Try to maximize it. Blow that shofar with real meaning. Put that lulav, the esrog, back on the tree. And Amir Tashem, the moon and sun will be blown away.